चार्ज शील प्रभुपाद की जाए, नामाचार्य श्री हरिदासा को भी जाए।
प्रभु को श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधर श्रीवासादि गौर भक्तवृंद की जय। साम वेद भक्तवृंद की जय। गौर अर्थ नंद ग्लोरी श्री सिंह ग्लोरी श्री सिंह ग्लोरी श्री ग्लोरी श्री श्री I think you have a verse in the Bible. Mahu Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutalesha Mati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Nithi Namani Namaste Saraswati Deve Gaudavanta Chandra Nivishesha Sutra Mati Pustatsa Vesa Padaya ओम ज्ञानम विमलम दर्शय तुम्हें शुभ कार्य सचिव नमः पंचकल्प त्रिभु सिद्धु what the nature of the material world is. Krishna says, who is the creator? He is certified that the material world is dukkhalaya and ashasvatam. Dukkhalaya means full of misery, and ashasvatam means temporary. Are you translating or is So Krishna made the world, and this is his judgment, so he knows what it's like. And it is the nature of the world that whatever we do on the material platform or by material means to solve our problems only serves to increase them. Prabhupada says the more we try to control material nature, the more we become entangled in their complexities. So, when we realize this, when we understand this about the material world, we realize that all the search for happiness that we are after here will be unsuccessful. It's an incompatible situation. We are eternal and we want eternal happiness. We're looking forward to a place where everything is temporary. This is our problem, our predicament. What to do? When one realizes this, then one becomes a candidate for spiritual life. One looks at this problem long enough. And with enough sincerity, we get the idea that there's another direction by which we should pursue our desire for happiness. There's nothing wrong with the desire for happiness. It's built in us because our nature is to be blissful. We're ananda. Satchitananda is the nature of spirit. So it's actually, we want it because it's just our nature to have it. But it's not here. You may remember the complaint by that great authority on material nature, Mick Jagger. I can't get no satisfaction. I try and I try. So that's what happens. So how to pursue happiness, spiritual happiness. Many people think this is an illusion. There used to be an old communist song making fun of religion that said, "There'll be a pie in the sky when you die." And that Marx famously said that religion is the opium of the people. It is the heart of a heartless world, it's the opium of the people. Actually, he's wrong. It turns out that the opium of the people is opium. Maybe in the 19th century. No, even then. So, is there really such a thing as spiritual happiness? Can we know what it is? And how do we get it? Is there some future promise that if we're good and we behave ourselves and then we'll die and we'll go to heaven and then we can cash our check? But we're never quite sure that it's going to be there. Maybe we don't know. So when we look to the spiritual experiences of the wise people of India, we actually see that there is actually a practical process for attaining spiritual state of being, even in this world. It's not when you die, it's now. It continues without the body, but right from the very beginning one can understand and have a taste of spiritual happiness. And so I'll start today with a few texts from the Bhagavad Gita where this is explained by Krishna. Maybe you want to get a German translation. Now let's look at chapter 6, and it's text 22-23. They're all single translation. Now read the English, and you can look at the German. So this chapter, the sixth chapter, is describing the principles of yoga. Six, then it goes 20-23. Those verses are all translated as in one block. This is the principles of yoga. And especially Krishna is applying these to bhakti yoga, you know, other different kinds of yoga. But the general principles are the same. So here he talks about these texts. It begins in the stage of perfection, which is called trance, or samadhi is the Sanskrit word. One's mind is completely restrained from material mental activities by practice of yoga. This perfection is characterized by one's ability to see the self by the pure mind and to relish and rejoice in the self. In that joyous state, one is situated in boundless transcendental happiness. The Sanskrit is sukham atyantikam. Sukham is happiness, not yantikam. Means both that it has no end and that it has no interruption. Sukham antyantikam. So this is what it is. Whatever passes for happiness in the material world, it has a beginning and an end, and is often interrupted. So this is different. Sukham Adhyatmikam, boundless transcendental happiness realized through transcendental senses. Established thus, one never departs from the truth, and upon gaining this, he thinks there is no greater gain. There's nothing better than achieving. Being situated in such a position, one is never shaken even in the midst of greatest difficulty. For one has realized this happiness, no matter what happens, it doesn't go away. This indeed is actual freedom from all miseries arising from material contact. In the material world, when we seek out happiness by the senses, our happiness depends upon the course of material nature. Whether our body is functioning well or not. Whether we have money or not. Whether we have friends or not. Whether the weather is good or the opposite. So all our happiness is depending on circumstances, the course of things in the world going the right way. And therefore we're always caught up in anxiety because we don't know what the future will bring. And at any time, whatever relation we have can happiness can turn around and become a source of misery. That's because our happiness depends upon the course of the world. And the ultimate course is old age, disease, death. That's the way it is. Here is happiness that does not depend upon material nature. It comes from another source. It comes from the spiritual platform. So that no matter what else is happening in the world, I stay the same. This is called freedom. I am not caught up in the dualities. This is good, this is bad, I like this, I don't like that. But this is what, and this is where the real source of actual happiness takes place. It is on the spiritual platform. One can see the self by the pure mind. The mind has become cleared of all kinds of garbage. And then the self becomes realized and the super self together. And we just start to see everything as it really is. We should understand that this it says here, one's mind is completely restrained from material mental activities. This is our problem is that we have our consciousness is now contaminated, and by that contaminated consciousness, our sense of self, our identity. Is invested in the material body and the material mind. And because of that, we lose our capacity for spiritual experience. Then, as a result of that loss, we become more desperate looking for happiness in the world, but everything we do to increase the happiness by material means increases the forgetfulness, increases our false idea of ourselves and thus makes us more miserable. So at first, you see, when one begins his spiritual life, there's a discipline involved of principles. In yoga, I mean, to really practice yoga the way you're supposed to is a spiritual path. Oh, it's so many rules and regulations you have to follow. First of all, one of the preliminary requirements is celibacy, brahmacharya. Or just like in the bhakti yoga principle, in the bhakti yoga system we have these four regular principles. We don't eat meat, fish, or eggs. We don't take any intoxications or intoxicants. We don't engage in illicit sex. No sex outside of marriage, and intimate marriage also restricted. Our goal is to become free from it altogether as much as possible. Not to increase it, but to decrease it as much as possible. And we don't gamble or engage in speculative enterprises. Sometimes I explain these principles to somebody and they look at me in bafflement, bewilderment, and say, well, what do you do? You can't imagine. What is it? And it looks like we are choosing to be miserable. Everything that gives people happiness, we're giving up. They think you must have some taste for self-torture or something like that. But actually, these things become the cause of happiness. Because we stop doing those things that actually make us miserable. It says later on in the Bhagavad Gita that it describes two different kinds of happiness. One, in the beginning, it is like nectar, but in the end, it is like poison. That's material happiness. And the other, in the beginning, is like poison, but in the end, it is like nectar. So there's spiritual disciplines that are involved. And in every religious tradition, the people that are really have achieved high levels of spiritual experience, they're all of them ascetics. They undergo austerities. The Christian saints going out into the desert or walling themselves off in the ruins. And in Buddhism, everywhere you see that these people, and of course India is famous for its ascetics who practice these austerities. What are they doing? They're seeking happiness. They're trying to become free, first of all, free from the miseries of material contact. Now sometimes it looks like negative endeavor. The world is causing me suffering, let's withdraw. And then you think that they're just seeking out indifference or apathy, which is not happiness either. Happiness is not just the sensation of pain. That's a purely negative idea of happiness. Here we see what Krishna says, there's nothing negative about it. It's boundless transcendental happiness. It is joy that has no end. And in fact, we learn other places that spiritual happiness is ever increasing. Not only does it go on forever, but it is always increasing. It's not that you reach some level and oh, this is the top. There is no upper limit. And actually, because spiritual happiness is dynamic, it grows. Ananda Bhumi Vardhanam. Chaitanya says that the practice of the chanting the holy name increases the ocean of transcendental bliss. It's like the ocean is already full, but it just keeps growing and growing and growing. So this is what it says here. I'll show you another place. Text 27 in the same chapter. The yogi whose mind is fixed on me verily attains the highest perfection of transcendental happiness. Sukham uttamam. Sukham is happiness and uttamam, the highest. Transcendental happiness. He is beyond the mode of passion. He realizes his identity, his qualitative identity with the Supreme, Brahma-bhuta. And he is free from all reactions to past deeds. There's no reactions, especially sinful activities. While one realizes his spiritual identity with Brahman, beyond the mode of passion, through the mode of passion is how most people seek their happiness, through the intense enjoyment of the sense of existence. To a spiritual person, what people do for happiness doesn't look like happiness. There's a famous incident in America where Prabhupada, for the first time, saw people on surfboards. And he said, "What are they?" And the devotee with him said, "They are surfers, Prabhupada." Prabhupada said, "Sufferers?" So that's sometimes how it looks. There's another place, one more verse. Now this is chapter 9, text 2. Here Krishna is introducing his explanation about spiritual knowledge. In the first text, he calls it Jnana Vijnanam Sahitam. This means that this Vijnana means that this is scientific knowledge. Normally, see, people think like somebody like me, I'm practicing a religion, and I have faith. Where over there in the university, they're practicing science, and they have knowledge. But the truth of the matter is, there is spiritual science. It's true that when one begins the spiritual process, it begins in faith. The description of bhakti yoga, the first step is adho shraddha. You have to at least have some preliminary first interest or confidence. Maybe they have something interesting to say. So in the beginning, there has to be some faith. That I'll go to a spiritual teacher and I'll learn something worthwhile. Is that anything different than what happens at a university? Say you're going to study chemistry. So you walk into a room you've never been in before. You see a gentleman up at the front, in front of the blackboard, that you've never seen before. You sit down and he's talking about things that no one has ever seen, atoms, protons, electrons, neutrons, and you believe every word he says. Why? Well, because you have faith. You have faith, this is an authorized university, this is a professor with a degree, and this is science, people know it works, and so on. So, but it is an act of faith. You may think it's so secure an act of faith that it's sound, but it is faith. It is faith. So, the truth is that all processes of knowledge begin in faith. At least there's some teacher you believe in. To teach you and guide you. So we're no different. And in the end, as when one becomes takes up the practice, there's what's called here vijnana. You see in the word for word in this in text 1, Prabhupada translates this realized knowledge. I'm in text 1, I'll look back one first. That there's realized knowledge. That means that it is experienced knowledge. First I may hear about it in the books, and then I realize it through my own experience. That's what we mean by science. That's what we mean by That's the word. Vijnana is often translated as science, because science means that you do things by your direct perception or direct experience. So we see this in the second text, where Krishna elaborates on this a little more. He's describing this vidya, this knowledge, or this science. First of all, Raja Vidya, it's the emperor of knowledge, the highest. Raja Guhyam. Guhyam means it's also secret, confidential. Prabhupada uses the word the secret of all secrets, he says. Because not everybody will appreciate it. So therefore it's called secret. Even though Krishna's it's in this book, Bhagavad Gita. But still it's not everybody can appreciate it. He describes it as pavitram. It is the purest knowledge. Pavitram means pure. And then he says pratyaksham avagavam dharmyam. Pratyaksham means it is understood by direct experience. This is the Sanskrit word pratyaksham. It breaks up into two words, prati aksham. Aksham means the eyes. Prati means in front of the eyes. So it means you see it directly. It gives direct perception of spiritual reality. Everywhere in the world, people say, what is this, you know, God, that's a fairy tale, the soul, that's a fairy tale. Because we don't see them. We don't see them. But they don't know how to see them. One has to undergo the discipline to gain the ability to perceive spirit. Because we are spirit, and Krishna, the Supreme Spirit, is with us at every moment. But because we have been using our intelligence and our mind and our senses for material enjoyment, we've lost that ability. It's our natural ability, but now it's gone away. We're all of us handicapped people. In a spiritual sense, we become deaf and dumb and blind and lame. A blind person can't see colors and forms. Other people say, well, yeah, it's here, I can see it. You can't. So there are plenty of people who see spirit. And so what else is about this knowledge? Susukam kartam avyayam. It is susukam, very, very happy. Very, very joyful to do. It's fun. A lot of fun. It's not the kind of knowledge you get from sitting up late at night with your eyes all bleary by the burning the midnight oil. You know? It's joyful. It is joyfully performed, he says. So when we want to come into contact with transcendence, when we come into contact with the spiritual reality, we become happy. We realize ourselves as a spiritual being, and we realize Krishna in relationship with Krishna, and then we see everything else in relationship with Krishna. Because the nature of Krishna, who is the source of everything, is that everything is in relationship to Krishna. Myself, you, everyone, everything. But the nature of what we call maya or illusion is I'm not able to see or experience that relationship. Then we don't see things as they really are. there's this veil of illusion that covers everything, and God disappears from view. We disappear. And we don't even see this world as it is. So we have to regain that vision. Now there's a problem. We are disabled spiritually, but without our capacity. There's this a verse by Rupa Goswami has put it into the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. Atasi Krishna Nama Nama Vedraya Nama. He says that our senses, our material senses, cannot perceive Krishna. When we try to see Krishna by our material senses and material mind, it is not there. He says, Krishna, we cannot see Krishna's name. We cannot perceive Krishna's name, Krishna's form, Krishna's qualities, or Krishna's activities. That's why when people try to look into the spiritual realm with the material mind and senses, they come up with nothing. Except it's a kind of divine nothing. This is the source of what we call impersonal philosophy. They by different means, they can somehow journey away from matter and toward spirit, and they see they're approaching something that's great and wonderful, somehow or other bright, but they cannot perceive it. They say, here all your mind and senses stop. They're attracted to it, but and if they come back, if they brush against it and come back to the world, they say it cannot be described in words. There's this describing that this when you look into transcendence with our material senses. But here, the second part of this verse, first Atasi Krishna Nama Deep Nada Vekraya Mindriya, our material senses and mind cannot perceive Krishna's name, his form, his qualities, activities. But then he says, Sivanu Keti Jiva Do Swaya Eva Swara Tvedaha. He says, but when those senses, those very same incapable senses, are engaged in Krishna's service, they gain this capacity. They become, first we're disabled, now we become enabled. And the idea is that originally we are servants of Krishna, and our as spiritual persons we have all powers of acting and receiving in relationship to Krishna. But now, having turned away, those powers have become manifest in the material life, and Krishna disappears. But at least as human beings, we can take these same senses, engage them in connection with Krishna, and the spiritual capacity returns. This is the principle of bhakti, bhakti yoga. The classical definition of bhakti, given in Narada Pancharatra, is Hrishikesha, Hrishikena, Sevanam. Bhakti, Uchite, bhakti is called. It means engaging the senses in the service of the master of the senses. That's the principle of it. Not to use the senses for material sense gratification, which only increases our misery. Not to reject them as useless, but to engage them and then our senses become purified. Yeah. And so that is the bhakti process. Then the advantage of this is that in the very beginning there's some contact with Krishna. Now in the beginning we cannot achieve that contact. Nevertheless, there's contact because we can't see spirit. In fact, you could ask, how am I going to engage my senses in Krishna's service if my senses cannot come into contact with Krishna? That is like a dilemma for us. How can I do that? So in the bhakti process, it takes advantage of the fact that from Krishna's side, he appears to us in the world in ways that we can bring our senses into contact with him. Even though we can't perceive spirit, he comes to us in the guise of something material. Take the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. There's syllables, huh? Ha, Re, Krishna, these are sounds. Sound is a material element. But here Krishna appears in the form of sound. So this sound I can make vibrate with my tongue, and I can hear with my ears. My senses are in contact with Krishna, Hare Krishna. And we are told that this sound does not originate from the material world. It descends from the spiritual world. In fact, the name of Krishna is full of all spiritual opulences and qualities. There's another verse, Nama Chintamani Krishna Chaitanya Rasa Vigraha. Shuddha Purna Purna Shidatvita Krishna. Shuddha Purna Nitya Mukto Abhinatva Nama Nama. The name of Krishna is Jet Chintamani, like a spiritual jewel. Spiritual gemstones. It is the form of all spiritual feelings, ecstasies, the Kamyavasa Vigraha. The name of Krishna is Purna. It means complete, full. Shuddha, pure, nitya mukta, always above the material realm. And then the last line answers the question, how could this be? Abhinatva nama namanaha, because there is abhina, no difference between the name and that which is named. To put it simply, Krishna and Krishna's name are the same. This is a characteristic of spirit. It is without duality. It is non-dual. So, Krishna is his name. And the material world, I say a name and it points to something. It's a sign that points to something else. But in the spiritual realm, it not only points to Krishna, it also is Krishna. If I say water, 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 my mouth is still dry. But if I say Krishna, Krishna is there. Because Krishna is present in his name. So for this reason, the name of the Lord, Hare is another name, Krishna, Rama, all of these names, and there's so many here. There's no good. For every quality that Krishna has, he has a name. Krishna is actually fully present. So this name is given to us by people who have seen Krishna and said his name, and that name has descended to the material world and is available to us. Now it looks like a material sound. We can't tell with spirit. But nevertheless, if we just accept it that here is Krishna in this form, then I'm told how that if I use my senses in connection with this sound by chanting and by hearing, which is how we relate to sound, then I am in contact, direct contact with Krishna. And because Krishna is pure, I become purified. That sound starts to get rid of some of the dirt that's covering my consciousness. So I just apply it. Say you have a pot that's very dirty, and you have to clean it. So to clean the pot, you have to work at it a little bit. You have to spend some time, and sometimes you have to use a little more muscle to get it clean. The same way we try to chant Krishna's name, so it stays in contact with our dirty minds, our dirty hearts, and I clean it out. And as that cleaning takes place, Krishna starts to appear. What actually happens is we actually start to perceive the true form of the name Krishna. Right now, I say the word, but I have to say in the beginning, I really do not know its meaning. Because in this case, the meaning is that it's Krishna himself. And Krishna has inconceivable transcendental characteristics. The name Krishna, it means all attractive. But I understand those words, all attractive. I've seen attractive things in this world, attractive women, attractive places to live. There are so many things that are attractive to the senses. There's attractive food, But when actually we see Krishna, then I understand this is what attractive really means. And everything else I thought was attractive was some pale reflection of this. So we say the name Krishna, we become purified, and then we find out what it is we are saying. Because Krishna becomes revealed in the form of his name. The very process purifies us of chanting, and it lets us actually understand what we are saying. Now, bhakti wants to engage all the senses. Maybe we start with sound. But we have all these other senses, and so Krishna's arranged so that all our senses can be engaged in his service. Here's the principle of Krishna and Krishna's name are the same. By the same principle, Krishna and Krishna's picture are the same. Krishna is a spiritual person. Those who are pure devotees have seen him. If you read Srimad Bhagavatam, it's a record of many people's spiritual experience of Krishna. And they have told it to us in language that's accessible to us. So they have seen him. in his spiritual form. Now, all the forms that we know are material forms. So we don't know what a spiritual form is. But nevertheless, these great souls can make an image of Krishna in the material world. So we have pictures of Krishna, or we have in our temples, we have deities of Krishna, a statue of Krishna, a Radha Krishna. And by the same principle, Krishna is none different from his statue. He and his representation in stone or wood are the same. In one lecture, Srila Prabhupada was talking about this. He says that God is not stone or wood. God is spirit. But he can appear as stone or as wood. Why should he want to do that? Because he looks at us and says, you're all rascals. You're all absorbed in the material world. You can't see spirit. All you can see is stone or wood. So for your sake, I'll appear as stone or as wood. So that even in your condition, you can see me. You see the picture here? You can put clothes on me. You can put garlands on me. And in the temple where we have full deity worship, we wake them up every morning and we give them a bath and we offer them sweets and rub their bodies with oils and, and dress them nicely. So here you have the very close relationship with Krishna. And we're not just playing with dolls. Because actually Krishna says, I'll take this form, I'll be available for you, so if you use your senses like this way, and now you have a relationship. And then, especially with deity, you can see that, but also if you engage in full deity worship, well, your hands are engaged, your sense of smell, everything is there. And anyone who does this, it's a very addictive activity, deity worship. I mean, and very quickly, very strong feelings toward Krishna go out. It's a wonderful experience, and so Krishna makes him accessible that way. The other thing we do with deities is we offer them something to eat. Now, Krishna's not hungry. He doesn't need anything to eat. But again, just to have a relationship, he says, if you feed me a leaf of fruit, fire, water, with love and devotion, I will accept it. He wants that spice, or devotion, or our love. He eats it. And then he gives his leftovers back to us, and now we can eat. And that is prasadam, the Lord's mercy, and if we eat material food that's just prepared for our material enjoyment, every bite we get deeper and deeper entangled in the material nature. Sages realize this problem of eating, and that's why in religion you see fasting is always a big thing. And you see these very skinny ascetics. And sometimes yogis, by practice, they hope to stop eating. They just live on air. That's really rough to do. By Krishna's arrangement, by giving us food that he's enjoying, with every bite we get closer to Krishna. So our sense of taste is engaged, our sense of smell is engaged. And when we cook so many other things, you know, our hands, our legs, we get very involved, and we're cooking for Krishna. While we're cooking for Krishna, we think of Krishna. So in this way, we engage everything in Krishna's service, and Krishna appears in all these different forms for us, so that we can bring our senses into contact with Him. Krishna also has a mission in this world. We read the Bhagavad Gita, he had some purpose to fulfill, and he asked Arjuna to engage in my service. Now, we are under the rule of Lord Chaitanya. And his mission is into warfare, in this case. So, to engage in his mission, we do all kinds of things. Now, again, our senses are engaged in Krishna's service, so we can stay with our senses in contact with Krishna. And the senses become purified. When we do this, we are always chanting Hare Krishna. That's like everything in devotional service, the center pole of everything is the chanting that's holding everything up. But in this way, we become purified, and we come into contact with Krishna. Pratyaksha abjamam is direct perception. Krishna appears. How fast? Well, in some ways it depends. It's generally a gradual process. But our thing is that we become attached to Krishna and detached to matter. Just to become detached from matter by itself is very difficult, but if we are becoming attached to Krishna, and simultaneously detached from matter, then Krishna becomes more and more available to us. And one can see very quickly the immediate effects of chanting and these other kinds of activities in devotional service. So here in this world we come into contact with Krishna, and we see Krishna and we see ourselves. So it is a spiritual discipline. I just want to say a few words about the central activity of chanting. We approach the Hare Krishna mantra, and we chant the holy names. And actually, because we're saying Krishna's personal name, it's really very friendly of Krishna to let us use his personal name. Most people say God Almighty. That's not a personal name. That's a position. but Krishna has personal names, and so. He's given us his personal names to chant, or to say, or to address him with. In the Hare Krishna mantra, all three words are in the vocative case in Sanskrit. Sanskrit is an old language, and therefore, when words are used as the subject, or the direct object, or the indirect object, the ending changes. In German, it happens with the der, die, and das, those change. But Sanskrit, sometimes the words in these change, but they're mostly going away in modern languages. Older languages like Latin and Greek, you have to memorize the ways of. And so Sanskrit's like that. And so the endings of those three were Hare Krishna and Rama all indicate you're calling him, calling his name. So it's not just Krishna, it's O Krishna, O Radha, O Hara, O Rama. So that there, again, there's a relationship. So when we chant the Hare Krishna mantra, the main thing we should try to do is to give Krishna our attention. we're calling him, and really we're inviting him, please appear in my heart. This, the mantra is also a prayer. Because Prabhupada gave us the meaning of this mantra. And it is said that when you chant a mantra, you should think of the meaning. So the meaning of the Hare Krishna mantra, Prabhupada says, is, O Lord, O energy of the Lord, that's Radharani, please engage me in your service. Please, we're asking something. We always should ask something from God, but we should know what to ask. If we really want transcendence, that's what we ask for. We don't ask for a Porsche or not even you. We appreciate the five things in this world. We ask for the service. We ask for Krishna's service. And so we're inviting him to come. So we should try to be respectful. In the sense that, say I invite somebody to my house. Say to the really important person that's coming to my house. Somebody I really want to establish a relationship with. A superior person, maybe somebody I may get a job from, or a professor who may become my academic guide, or my spiritual master, somebody important who's coming to my house. I'm inviting. So what I need to do, at least, is show them attention. That's just etiquette, right? I mean, it's just that when a guest comes, you're at the door, you receive them, come in, please sit down. What happens when this person comes and they're knocking on the door and there's no answer? And then finally I yell from the back, come on in, I'm busy in the back. This is the word for this is rude. It does not please the people you are calling do not feel like you really want them. So we have to let Krishna know that we want him. So that's why the rule is we have to be attentive. And this, in the sixth chapter I was reading from, it describes the process of yoga is making the mind attentive. When you fix it on Krishna, if the attention wanders, you bring it back. So we discover if we sit down, especially if we have our beads and we're trying to meditate on Krishna by japa with his holy name, that our mind has this distressing and even embarrassing and humiliating tendency to wander off. What am I supposed to do? As soon as I notice it's wandering, I bring it back. Now really, if there's love for Krishna, it doesn't wander. In fact, it can't. In fact, it's hard to think of anything else. I really have to force my mind to sign the check, sort of. So it's true, I have no love for Krishna yet, but I want to have love for Krishna, so at least I show him I'm interested, and so that if my attention wanders, I bring it back. If my mind wanders and I just let it drift and I get so many good ideas and interesting thoughts, then that really will not be very much effective, because I'm just not there to show Krishna some attention and to show him he's wanted. So I decided I want Krishna. It's true. I have become a devotee, and I know I want Krishna. My mind doesn't sometimes. I have become a devotee, but my mind it still has bad habits, and so. The other thing is why we need a little discipline is we have to train our mind. Our mind has had the habits of material life. It has the habits of sense gratification. And it just wants to keep on going. Any habit is like that. As soon as you try to change a bad habit, you know, it's hard. And so every so often you have to take your mind and slap it around a little bit and get tough and go to war. You may feel sometimes you're like a little bit of a divided person, but gradually, so it's okay. You know? Oh, now this was my experience when I became a devotee. And there was just a new devotee. One time I met my old friends that I used to do many things with. And we sat and talked for a little while, and then one of them who really liked me says, "You know, I think this is very bad for you." I said, "Why?" She said, "Well, you used to be so together. and now you're just, you're not at all, you know, together and, you know, at ease with yourself, and now you're all..." Anyway, I knew what she meant, you know, and I didn't know how to answer. I was at war with myself. Not really myself, but my mind, you know. I was not... Before, I used to be one, I used to flow with it. I was one with the senses and material sense activities, and now my mind was still trying to flow with it, and I was trying to change the flow. So this is typical, you know. In the beginning, you're not, you're maybe together as a materialist, then you become a devotee, and you find yourself, "I'm a devotee, but my mind is not," and so you feel like there's a war inside. It's like you're living in a flat with another person, and it's a nasty guy. But it's good to know that you are not your mind. I mean, this, when we say "aham brahmasmi," "I'm not my body," it also means "I'm not my mind," and this is actually very good news. And so, gradually, by practice, the mind becomes purified, and then again, when we have good habits, when the mind has been trained to think of Krishna, then we can flow with it again. We become together again. And so this is the process of purification. And so there's a discipline involved. But we're not on our own, because we are dealing with Krishna. And Krishna wants us back. And really, we sometimes find we do not have so much strength and so much power. But if Krishna can see by our honest effort that we are sincere, he also helps us and also makes arrangements for us, so that bhakti yoga makes the highest level of spiritual life accessible. When I first got interested, I got disgusted with the material world, and I began to study different religions. And, you know, you would read about these people, these St. Francis of Assisi, or Shankaracharya, or Buddha, you know, these kind of Olympic athletes of spiritual life, you know. And they were all in the past, you know. I mean, today, who could be a saint? It's just like they were back then, but not anymore. But what Prabhupada really did is he made the prospect of becoming a saint, you know, a live possibility, a vocation you could take up, because it is doable. It's practical, and it can be applied. And it's bhakti yoga is especially Lord Chaitanya's form of it is made for incapable people. I'm not an Olympic athlete of the spirit, but by following this process, I can gradually become to the highest level. And so this is application. And at the beginning, we study and read about it, and then we apply it. And it has to be under guidance. It's like anything. To learn how to do. You can read so many books on playing the piano, but ultimately you have to get down and put your hands to the keys. You can read so many medical books, but you're not going to be able to practice medicine unless you have some training under a doctor. These things that are applied, we need guidance. But then when we apply it, we know what happens. The people who have gone on this path have left behind for us, first this will happen, then this will happen, then this will happen. You should see these things happening at this stage. If it's not happening, then we can look and say, oh, well, there's something you're doing wrong. What is it? Let's look at it. Let's fix it. Like any applied science. And so this is what we need to do. We are seeking for happiness. It's not available in the material world. This is what we're really looking for. This is what we should spend our time on. Everything else we do is really a waste of precious time. This is the thing. And we have all facility, everything that we need to do this. Okay, I'll stop there.
I thought that
I'm not criticizing.
I thought that Francis of Assisi, like the top athletes. I thought that especially when I joined, there was something like a role model, some advanced role model. You have to be super sattvic, mm-hmm. always calm in mind, and mm-hmm. like that. And sometimes we see for example, I saw him become angry even on video. but he said some things like, the Holy said, Prabhupada, you appear to us just like a king. And he said, I'm much more than a king. When I read Mahabharata in my mind, I see all those fancy characters, everybody's very unique and they all get qualities. Mm-hmm. That do not fit in that role model.
I saw Prabhupada sometimes really, really angry. and people think, oh, yeah, if you're angry, that's a mode of ignorance, you're not a saintly person. But all our emotions can be used in Krishna service. If you're angry for the right person at the right time in the right place, it's not anger because of frustration or sense gratification, then it's actually also purifying. And it's a little different. There's two things about anger. People who have felt the anger of Srila Prabhupada felt blessed. They felt they really got his mercy. The other thing is, it's that he was really angry, but then it'd be over, it would just be finished, just be gone in 1 second. One time when Prabhupada came to my city in 1975 for Ratanatra, I was still in university, in this PhD program, and I brought an Indian man who was one of my professors to see Prabhupada. He wanted to meet Prabhupada's professor, and the professor came, and a couple of my fellow students were with him. They came, probably a room full of devotees. He came, we sat down, and Prabhupada said, "So what do you teach?" And the professor said, "Hinduism." And Prabhupada said, "And what is that, Hinduism?" And he says, "I don't know. I don't know what is Hinduism. You tell me what is Hinduism," he said to Prabhupada. And this is how it started. And Prabhupada said, he said, you are teaching and you do not know. And then there was a Swarabdhamara sitting there. And Prabhupada, this is Swarabdhamara, he's a PhD. Let us hear his judgment. He is teaching and he does not know. And Swarabdhamara, what is that? And Swarabdhamara on cue says, cheater, cheater. This is how it started, you know. And this professor, Bhagavati Yadav, he got really pretty heady. And probably wouldn't let him go, you know, he was just on his case. And there were some really funny moments, you know. At one point, he said that Prabhupada quoted Mame Kam Saranam Bhaja. Krishna says, you just surrender to me. The professor said, what is the meaning of surrender? And Prabhupada looked at the guy at the devotee next to him and says, give me a dictionary. And Yadav blew up and said, no, I want the Sanskrit etymological meaning of Sharanam Braja. And Prabhupada looked at him and said, we cannot waste our time like this. You do not want a spiritual master. You want a Sanskrit teacher. It was like, put these little things like that. And then he kept demanding that Prabhupada tell him, you know, what is Hinduism? And the way Prabhupada was telling him, but it was too close to reality. He just was on a theoretical platform, and Prabhupada was saying basically that if you want spiritual knowledge, you have to approach a spiritual master, and in the right way, you know. So at one point he was demanding that Prabhupada teach him, and then Prabhupada said, first you become shaven-headed like Venus, then I will teach you. And then he said, Padvidi Pranipatena Paripashena Sevya. When you approach a spiritual master, it's Pranipat. And then he said, and then Yadav said, I gave my pranams, because he'd done like this. And then Prabhupada said, then my first honor to you is to stop this cheating business. And Prabhupada never gave an inch to him, because at a certain point he admitted he was a cheater. He says, yes, it's true, I am a cheater. And, but then he said, but I am an honest cheater. And this is what Prabhupada said. You say you are honest, but the judgment of a cheater cannot be accepted. So finally, you know, Yadav left. And I think that GBCs, when I was a temple president, the GBCs were looking at me like, why did you do this? Why did you do this? Prabhupada was shaking with sugar. The things they were saying. As soon as Yadav left, they said, oh, Prabhupada, look at this nice newspaper. I kind of calm him down, you know. So the I was awake all night thinking how I was going to apologize for bringing this guy. So the next morning I was driving him on his morning walk, you know, so I was in the car and Prabhupada got in, and so I was just ready to say my thing, and I said, Srila Prabhupada, I'm sorry I brought that professor to see you yesterday. I said, I didn't realize what a demon he was. And Prabhupada just looked at me surprised and says, oh, he says, well, that's all right. And he says, at least he was chastised. A great satisfaction. Mm. But then, of course, I'm still a student in the same department with this guy, and I can't even look at him. You know? He was really angry, and he was going around to all the other Indians and complaining how Prabhupada treated him, you know. And then about 5 years later, now see, his name was Yadav. That means he was from a Vaishnava family originally. But, you know, he was like all theoretical, all this Buddhism stuff and things like that. So then about 5 years later, he said to me, you know, Prabhupada made me really angry, but actually he really helped me. And he had gone back to being a Vaishnava, a Pushtimar Vaishnava. It took him 5 years to find himself again. So I was really seeing, you know. So these things can be used in Krishna service. And somehow in Prabhupada, it wasn't like he was shaking with anger. But then immediately, you know, well, at least he was chastised. Everybody else was all upset, but he was. I think he was having a good time.
So that role model is not worth that much?
You have to see people in action. You know, it's just, there's a stereotype. I don't know if it's a role model. There's a stereotype that a saint is some spaced out person that floats above the world. It's not exactly like that. You know, even Jesus is depicting and getting angry and chasing people out of the temple and things like that. Those kinds of emotions in connection with Krishna, they are not contaminated. They don't degrade. You're not angry, upset, unmad at yourself at all. And there's no false ego involved. It's not that somebody has put you down or somebody has. A person is really, really detached. And when David Baba could make a remark like, you know, what would you quote? I'm better than the king and stuff like that. He was so funny, you know. So the one thing about being with Prabhupada all the time, you know, whenever you're with him, you suddenly realize he was having such a good time. And he was just so funny. Then he could be so serious, but I'm always ready to be cracking like really funny jokes and stuff. Just really amused at people. He was just always having a good time. And the other thing is, it's just amazing to be with somebody who had no false ego. He was in the middle, surrounded by disciples, and he was just himself. He was like a simple. Prabhupada was so simple. He was a simple devotee who was simply trying to satisfy his spiritual master. That's all there was to it. Nothing, you know, nothing fancy or anything else. It was something to see. One time, as one of my early experiences, we were seeing Prabhupada off. He was leaving in New York City on an airplane. We always used to set up a Vyasana and have an arti in the airport. Those days, airports were really different. Yeah, we had Vyasana, have arti, garlands, and then a press conference and all these. You know, we arrange it ahead of time. You know, the airport let us move like that. But when Prabhupada was leading, it was always a smaller crowd and no big fuss, and people would like it because they could just, it was more intimate. So he was leaving for the West Coast at LaGuardia Airport in New York, and there's a crowd of devotees there. There's enough devotees that when Prabhupada went and sat down in where the passengers sit there, I don't know what you call it, boarding area or whatever, the chairs there. It filled up with devotees. Prabhupada just sat down on one of these little bucket seats, and people were sitting on side of them on the floor and everything, and there was some talking going on. And I was a little late or something, so I was on the outside of the crowd. So there was like a kind of people with their backs sort of me. I was just there listening, trying to hear what people were saying. But because I was on the outside of the crowd, I saw that the airline gate people were very upset because there were other passengers for the plane. And they couldn't get into the boarding area because all these devotees were gathered around Srila Prabhupada. And I noticed him trying to, you know, get a devotee's attention to let the other passengers in. And they just rushed on, looking at Srila Prabhupada, you know. And so I thought I would try to guide. I didn't think we should make a bad impression of them. So I nobody would pay attention to me either. So I saw my GDC, whose name was Rupanuga, standing nearby. So I came over and got Rupanuga. I said, "Look, you know, people are trying to get into this the boarding area, the gate, the airport. People airline people are really upset." So he tried to get some people to move, and nobody was paying attention. So this is what he did. He stood up. It was like a little table, you know. He stood up on the little table, leaned over everybody, and he said, "He says, all the boat devotees, leave the boarding area at once, right now." And there was a shocked silence, and everybody standing, looking up in horror. And before anybody could move, Prabhupada got up and started to walk out. Meek look on his face. And Rupanuga started laughing. He says, "Not you, Srila."
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he's just like it was kind of fall of waters, you know. And everybody else looked offended, you know. So that's bigger than an emperor, you know. Anything else you want to ask about? Yeah?
I have one question first. So the first is, what is the way to see myself as different from my mind? Because the body is here, everything is changing, and the body is changing and so on. But when I think I'm not the mind, it's a thought, and the thought is also in the mind. So how do I see myself different?
So sometimes it seems like you have two minds. I don't think it's a problem on a practical level, because actually above the mind is the intelligence, and it's intelligence which directs our attention. Our mind thinks and feels and wills, and it does so in terms of sense gratification. And that's like the whole mindset, because it's been trained that way with its habits. So when we become a devotee, in a way we start to give directions to the mind. Don't think of this, think of that. So that may be expressed in the mind, but really where it's coming from is buddhi, which is higher. So that's why Krishna consciousness is called buddhi yoga. And buddhi, intelligence, when it's fully developed, it shows Krishna. It's because buddhi is just a manifestation of Krishna's directions. So our mind is thinking and feeling and willing, all in terms of sense gratification. I am accepting or rejecting things. Whatever is favorable for my sense gratification, I accept. Whatever is unfavorable, I reject. I want to be a devotee so that mind is not doing what I want. What I want, and so I train the mind, You will still accept and reject, but you accept the things that are favorable to Krishna consciousness and you reject the things that are unfavorable. And when you get those habits, then the mind is your friend. The Bhagavad Gita says in the beginning of the sixth chapter, the mind is either your friend or your enemy. And so in the beginning it's your enemy, but once it's been retrained, it's your friend. So you can detach yourself from the mind and retrain it, and that's because of a buddhi. That's attention functioning that way. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Yes. If there's anything which can direct my mind, so I am able to direct my mind, so it's already the difference.
Yeah, that's right. The mind, like is, you know, the Russian Pavlov. You know this. We took the dogs and did that famous experiment. I think it's what they call classical conditioning. You know, just these habits that get built in. So you know, you ring the bell and the dogs get hungry. So that's where the mind is. You know, it's just like a computer that's been programmed. So intelligence, you can reprogram it. That's an example.
Another verse about that Krishna is equal to his name. No,
the same as his name.
So from the mathematics of this equation, like something is equal to something else, it also means like it's a one-to-one relationship. So one is, but with Krishna it seems that name of Krishna is Krishna, but not, but Krishna is not only his name. So it's like, Krishna is not just this vibration, just this sound vibration, just this sequence of
sounds. Well, yeah, because it appears in the form of a sound vibration. But but at the same time, if you just become absorbed in that sound vibration, it becomes identical with the object. And there's a revelation takes place. Nama, Rupa, Guna, Lila. Krishna's name is revealed. As Krishna's name is revealed, his form is revealed. His qualities are revealed, and then his pastimes are revealed. And that's all there in the name of Krishna. That's what it is said. If Krishna and Krishna's name are the same, means that when I say Krishna, everything with Krishna is the same as the name. Or the other way you could say, like Srimad Bhagavatam is the same principle. When I hear Bhagavatam the right way, Prabhupada says we see Krishna directly in the pages. Because the book describes, here's a book and it describes something over here. But the book disappears, and it's like if you read a book about New York City, you're reading a book and you could try to imagine, you know, here's Fifth Avenue. Whatever book you, oh, as soon as you read it, you were there. That's what it means.
Not the letters, but the meaning of the letters.
Yeah, you can say that. Yeah. It's
also not the vibration, but the meaning of this.
Although, it's not strictly true, because Ajamil said the syllables Narayana. He was thinking of his son, but still, because there was something there, he actually came. So it's a little more complicated than that. I have to think about it a little more about how exactly. Anyway, some of these things are a little hard to figure out, but it is the sound. Yeah. Because again, if there's a sound and there's a meaning of it, also, I mean, the name Krishna has a meaning, and it's the same. I don't know if there's duality. Did you have a question?
I had a question. Because of the question of mind and intelligence,
mm-hmm.
Is it possible to identify them with the intelligence? I thought all the time identify myself with the body, then comes the mind, then comes the intelligence, and then comes the 14.
Yes, that's right.
So when I say okay, I try to program my intelligence in another way. So don't I get to another level only, not to identify with the mind, but with the intelligence, and then I have the same problem again.
No, if you don't identify with the intelligence. It's not like that, but it's just using intelligence in Krishna's service.
Mm-hmm.
There's no harm in having a material body if I use it in Krishna's service. If my mind is engaged in Krishna's, there's no problem with the mind, there's no problem with the intelligence, if it's in order. And then something happens, then the ego becomes not the false ego.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes the true ego. That means I don't identify with the body and the mind anymore. But actually I see that all these things, who really is controlling my intelligence and my mind and my body is Krishna. That means, and they don't belong to me, they belong to Krishna. I'm sitting here on the chariot of his body and mind, and then, you know, Krishna is driving. So I'm still not the body, but then the body does no harm whatsoever. It's just simply being used under Krishna's direction, Krishna's service. And ultimately, I'm not doing anything. Krishna is the one that runs material nature. And in a sense, I'm just along for the ride. Okay? Anything else? Yeah, I sit here telling you what, but you know, I guess people could, I don't know, they're supposed to be prasad, but I don't know when people are going to start to get hungry, but go ahead, I mean, it's up to you.
One more. Funny question, why do we sleep?
Why do we
sleep? Because in the inner, especially, for example, today, after such a program, I had such a lecture. The world seems to be very clear. It's clear what to do, it's clear how to engage, it's mm-hmm. everything like. But then the night comes, and in the morning I have to struggle again.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the use of this sleeping? Sometimes the relationship is continually going, you know.
Well, I suppose, you know, I have never really heard from Bhagavatam or any spiritual, what the use of sleeping is. But, you know, I hear different things from neurologists who tell why we have to do it and what's supposed to go on. But then, you know, Arjuna is called conqueror of sleep, Gudakesha. He conquers sleep. And ultimately, when the mind comes under control, also sleeping comes under control. And that when Prabhupada says we should come to the point of remembering Krishna 24 hours a day, he means it. Doesn't mean, you know, 18 hours and then you sleep. So that actually, when the state of Krishna consciousness becomes advanced, that you remember Krishna in your sleep. And in one sense, you don't lose consciousness the way one seems to lose consciousness now. You stay conscious and you stay Krishna conscious. But there's some physical need for the brain or to stop doing certain things. I don't know why it has to be like that. Even Brahma sleeps for a long time. It's recreation. That seems to be in the nature of things.
Like the body needs rest. I remember reading in the Bhagavatam that the intelligence is sleeping. Actually, it's not the mind. The mind goes on in your dreams.
But what Bhagavatam says, the mind is active.
Doesn't need a break.
But something stops. It says that being asleep and being awake are functions of intelligence. I don't know if it means that the intelligence goes to sleep and awake, but it's a function of intelligence. Those going back and forth between those two states is something that's governed, I understand, is governed by, ruled by buddhi or intelligence. But there's a lot of, I don't know about all that stuff. But the state of Krishna consciousness, it says there's three states of, that they mention. Waking, dreaming sleep, and deep dreamless sleep, susupti. And then spiritual consciousness is called turiya, the fourth state, beyond all those. Yeah. The Turiya, the fourth. Look, there's certain things that are not in our material experience. Just like we can experience happiness in of a certain kind in the mode of passion. Mode of ignorance is just misery. But in this mode of passion, there's a certain kind of thing that we call happiness. And the mode of goodness is another kind of happiness, which is actually closer to real happiness. But the state of Krishna consciousness, or spiritual consciousness, is beyond the mode of goodness. The mode of goodness gives you a little idea of what it's like, but the mode of goodness does not seem to be very intense. If you really want intensity, you need a mode of passion. But we see Lord Chaitanya in the spiritual thing, he's in the mode of, Vishuddha Sattva is like goodness. But he has these incredible intense emotions, tears and all these things like that. But that's not like a material excitement. It's very different. So it's hard for a person who only have these material experiences to understand exactly what it is. Just like if you're colorblind and you can't tell the difference between blue and green, nobody's going to be able to explain it to you unless somehow or other you see it. But we know how to get there. Okay. All right. Thank you. I think it's really spellbound. I don't care for very much. It's late for me. I just have a little taste on
that. So John went in the mode of pessimist morning time. I thought it was
intense,
like an
brief and followed by a great deal of suffering.
You pay for it.
You should. Because the result of the mode of passion is misery. Mm-hmm. That's what happens. The mode of passion is characterized by this narrow, excited consciousness, intensely focused on the object of desire. And then you get what you want and it's over, and immediately you disenchant it, looking for something else. And meanwhile, in your pursuit of the object of desire and in possessing it, you've committed so many crimes you don't even notice or care about if you do notice. But, it's just terrible. Well, you know, when the devotees hear about the mode of goodness, they think it sounds like being born.
Being what? Born.
Boring, yeah. Yeah. But it's not really boring, because it actually has a different kind of intensity. But consciousness in the mode of goodness is characterized by a kind of peaceful, detached awareness, but really interested and very alert. As what? Yeah, well, you're going to... Look, I mean, people in the mode of ignorance, they're miserable, but also somehow they think it's like happiness too. You know, they haven't had a taste for it, because a mode of passion, it's like mode of ignorance is so much laziness that you just can't be bothered to do anything. But a mode of passion, you know, you just got to keep moving. It's always restless. But the mode of goodness is in some sense, it looks like the mode of ignorance, because again, it's peaceful. There's no activity, you know, a lot of activity. But instead of being dull and kind of shutting down awareness, it's extremely alert. And the mode of goodness, the happiness, comes from the accumulation of knowledge, of understanding things, of seeing things. I mean, with the mode of goodness, that there's a kind of curiosity, but it's detached. The curiosity of the mode of passion is to enjoy something or to give something. But with the mode of goodness, it's just everything is interesting just for its own sake.
I often met people when I told them that they are, you know, material life and so much suffering and that all the duality. Often people say, yeah, but it's okay, we need this duality,
yeah, right,
to have this, to be good and being pain belongs to us, then it's okay, I would miss it. I even had someone who said it's okay for her, the pain is important.
Don't
go to the
hospital.
Why?
They tried to tell her, but
they would
not believe.
She thinks
that
to be able to enjoy more than...
Because you don't see, if I can enjoy more, if I suffer more, why don't I take a knife and start cutting my arm open so that I'll be happier? They don't do that, do they? Even though theoretically they say that's what's happening, they don't do that. I come at somebody tonight, this is to make you enjoy more.
And I think it's part of life. It's part of life. It's so packaged.
It's really sad, those arguments, you know. What can we do? That's what people think, there's no alternative, and then they try to make the best of it. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow and watch. That's an awful lot.
I was thinking about
Yeah,
they are. They're really important.
I thought they were only like 100.
No, those are the ones that they give you for your use and not portable. Because they make their money on the ink.
Well, that's not
the correct way to spend it. They spend a lot of money on it.
It does sound like money on the ink.
Yeah.
And I was asking them, that's one, you know, like the biggest electronic warehouse.
Yeah, well, they're cable TV in Latin America. Yeah, so long as in that area, then he had a nice sheet.
Not many more appreciated.
So here's the verse. The spirit of Odin from the Lord. A pure devotee of the Lord whose heart has once been cleansed by the process of devotional service never relinquishes the lotus feet of Lord Krishna, for they fully satisfy him as a traveler is satisfied at home after a troubled journey.
Every 1 or 2 years I can come. I think the last time he was there, there was like 50 programs in all. It was like 150th program. That was the last time he was there. Probably we sometimes meet, so he never comes to the program. And right now, I think
Would you do a favor for me?